Welcome to DCU's Teaching Enhancement Unit Podcasts, an audio discovery series for teaching and learning in higher education. Hello, my name is Lisa Donaldson, and welcome to another episode in DCU's Teaching Enhancement Unit Podcast called A Discovery Series for Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. I'd like to welcome Zita Lysett here today, who's a lecturer in the School of Policy and Practice in the Institute of Education. Welcome, Zita. Let me start by just asking you to introduce yourself a little, please.
Good morning, Lisa, and good morning to everybody who's listening. So as Lisa has said, I'm Zita Lysett and I work in the School of Policy and Practice at Dublin City University. I'm a former primary teacher, and before working in the Institute, I was in the Education Department within St. Patrick's College, and prior to that within the Special Inclusive Education Department. There's a gap of about 20 years now, Lisa, between the primary teaching bit and joining, okay. But I won't go into that this morning.
Okay, perfect. So this morning, Zita, we're going to talk a little bit about constructive alignment. So we have a few prepared questions, but I think we'll probably just let it flow. But perhaps you can just start with taking us through some of the key principles around constructive alignment and backward design.
Okay, happy to do that. Lisa, can I suggest we do something a little...
Of course.
Off course and a little unexpected here. I was thinking about this, and in keeping with the principles of backward design, with which I think many of the people who are listening will be familiar, you know, we tend to start with the end in mind. So I'm conscious that, you know, there's a couple of key messages that I'd like to share in this podcast this morning. So I'm going to start with the end in mind, if that's with you.
Absolutely.
There are a couple of key takeaways. And for me, these are issues that have been bubbling up in my own head in the context of using constructive alignment and using backward design in my teaching, that have kind of caused a little bit of concern. So the reason for that is because I'm a big advocate of formative assessment. Mm-hmm. It means that in my teaching, in my in the design of modules, I very deliberately and explicitly design teaching and learning and assessment so that they're integrated. So that rather than adopting a linear kind of approach where we typically teach, the expectation is the students will learn, and then we assess it and then we move on, often in a modular kind of atomistic way, my feeling is that it's best conceptualized as a triangle, so that minute to minute and day by day assessment is central to what we do. Now, yes. What that means in practice is that even though I go into a lecture and I'm very well prepared, I know what the destination is, hence the backward design principle, it necessitates a certain contingency or an adaptive expertise on my behalf. So it means that it's not just what I have prescribed or what I have planned that is the direction of the potential end game of the lecture or a module. It's what the needs are in the moment of the students. So mm-hmm. My key takeaway here is that as a teacher, and I'm going to own this, as a teacher, I have been operating the principles of backward design and constructive alignment, particularly at the modular and programmatic design level, but it doesn't sit entirely well or consistently with what I do when I'm actually working with students.
Okay, so there's some degree of flexibility within yes. What you do. Yes.
Yeah. So now so the key thing, I suppose, one of the key takeaways this morning is, for me, there is that tension. That tension needs to be recognized, it needs to be addressed. I think to address it, we've got to reconceptualize backward design a little bit. And in particular, we need to look at the learning theory that underpins it, which is not always explicit. And we also need to ensure that there is a degree of flexibility in the manner in which we set up our teaching, learning and assessment experiences, notwithstanding the fact that we need some kind of a backward design framework to allow the programs to run, to ensure that, you know, we can design modules which are clear in terms of what it is we want students to learn, which allow for alignment, if you like, between the modules and our programs that ensure that, for example, we are graduating students who can be accredited in particular, you know, professions, mm-hmm. because of signature pedagogies and so on. So for me, there is an obligation on us to recognize the tension and then to include that somehow in our design. The final thing I'll say so the final takeaway in terms of how this happens, Lisa, for me is I think twofold. The first is that we need to consider working intradisciplinary and an interdisciplinary manner, saying there are signature learning outcomes that need to be identified and need to direct our planning, our teaching and our assessment within our areas. Mm-hmm. That if we look at it more broadly, then we can also say that in the context of 21st century skills,
yeah,
the context of empowering and educating the whole person rather than the person in a particular discipline, that we also perhaps consider what are the additional learning outcomes that are not discipline or module specific that we could build in across programs and across modules, which allow us that kind of flexibility in both in our design and in our teaching ultimately. Now that's now kind of put everything out there and I've got to work my way back.
Absolutely. There's many, many dimensions to consider when you're looking at your course design. So let's go back then. So okay. You've spoken eloquently about constructive alignment and your concerns around the tensions therein, backward design. For those that perhaps would like to learn a little bit more about those, can you just share a little bit about what constructive alignment is about and backward design?
They're actually very intuitive concepts. So they're like first cousins. They're not the same, but you'd often see in references that the two are mentioned. So let me just mention that, say that to begin with, and then separate them out. When we talk about backward design, we're talking about a design framework. It's attributed to Tyler, who was a US educator. More recently, it would be people like Wiggins and Tai who would have brought that forward. And essentially what it means is that backward design, you design with the end in mind. So you work backwards. So you say, what's the destination in terms of knowledge, skills, concepts, attitudes that I want the students to master individually and collectively at the end of this module or program of study? You establish those. And having established those, if you like, you've set your compass and then you work your way back and you say, okay, how do we reach that? What then is the journey in terms of the conditions and the criteria of performance is how I would group them. The conditions of performance are the conditions of learning. So the resources, the methodologies, the pedagogies, the groupings, the structures, the supports. The conditions, they're the conditions. The criteria of performance are the standards or the assessments, the modalities that we will employ for our students and ourselves to ensure that they have met the targets. So the design principle, you start with the end in mind and you work your way back. Mm-hmm. The constructive alignment is a cousin of that or is associated with that. And there are two elements to it. It's constructive and it's alignment. So let me deal with the two aspects of constructive alignment. The reference to constructive the word constructive is a reference to constructivist learning theory, the idea that students are actively involved in the co-creation of knowledge and skills, that they're not simply, you know, receiving the information as would be kind of indicative of a transmission model or a behavioral model of teaching and learning. So that's the idea that in the construction of the design of your teaching and learning assessment, you assume that the students are going to be active participants and co-construct meaning. Okay, that's a constructive element. The alignment element is that you align assessment, learning and teaching so that from a systems perspective, they're not out of sync. Now we associate this work in particular with John Biggs. And he also would have advanced the solo taxonomy of learning outcomes, which allows people to identify and to differentiate different levels of learning and to align that with different kinds of teaching or pedagogies and also to ensure that you have different levels and expectations in relation to your assessments, so that there is some kind of flexibility for the learner within the teaching, learning and assessment framework, in recognition of the fact that, you know, we come to the teaching table or the learning table with different needs and with different mental models, and that these should be the springboard for the teaching and the learning. And this, the teacher and the student's job is to try to continuously deprivatize these, so that both the teacher and the learner can check for understanding in real time, check for misunderstandings also, because they're a great learning opportunity. But the key principle is that they remain aligned.
Yeah.
That if a student is told at the beginning of a series of lectures or classes that the objective, for example, is, you know, to be able to critically review the concepts of backward design and constructive alignment, and to apply those principles to teaching and learning, that when he or she then looks at the assessment modalities, they go, ah, okay, they're aligned, I see. I know how that's going to be assessed, and I can see the extent to which, you know, are the ways in which I can demonstrate my knowledge and learning, and so on. And also I can see how the teacher or the instructor is going to craft and support and scaffold that learning in the repertoire of learning resources and supports and contexts that he or she is going to offer me.
That's a great explanation. I don't think Bix could have done better.
Thank you. It's the day.
So in speaking around that, then obviously there's some challenges, some of which you've already noted. What are the advantages, do you think, of using this kind of an approach, a very structured approach?
Well, one of them, Lisa, and one of the reasons why these have gained such traction is because they make intuitive sense.
Yeah.
And because they're actually not that, well, on the face of it, they're not that difficult. Actually, it's not that difficult to say, okay, what do I want the students to learn, and to follow a kind of a roadmap. So you A, B, C. So I'm going to start, and actually I start with the C, then the B, and then the A. I work my way back. It's something that people can embrace. It's been well researched. It's been well articulated. There are plenty of examples there. So there are a lot of advantages. It's a good scaffold for us. It knits nicely with teaching and learning, particularly when you amalgamate backward design with constructive alignment. The principles are they're attractive, because particularly within the constructive alignment design framework, because intuitively, particularly, you know, in current conversations about 21st century learning, we're very aware of the difference between the routine and the adaptive expertise that we need to imbue. And therefore, it makes sense that we espouse a theory of learning that is at the very least constructivist in nature. So it sits nicely with our philosophies. One of the biggest problems, however, and this is not always very obvious, is that backward design is not explicit in relation to its underlying theory of learning. So you could apply backward design to your module design or program design, and then apply a very strict behavioral or cognitive kind of a teaching lens. Mm-hmm. In that case, if it's very behavioral, as you know, Lisa, you know, that means that you really are holding all of the cards as the teacher.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a carrot and stick. So there's very little that the student can do to own their learning journey. And that's a big issue. The second tension or challenge in it is that it actually places a considerable pressure on the person who's designing the module, and that's typically a lecturer, to know, first of all, how to craft clear learning outcomes. And there's a whole research on that, because we talk a lot about smart learning outcomes, they're specific, measurable, retainable, and so on. But if there's any kind of ambiguity, or if they're any way nebulous, then in their architecture, then it means that when we're working back to the conditions and criteria of performance, we very quickly run into difficulty, because we're entirely clear what it means, for example, to say we want students to be familiar with or aware of, or, you know, to engage with. What exactly does that mean in terms of?
I would agree with you. Crafting good learning outcomes, there's a lot of skill and knowledge involved with that. Certainly, I know we have delivered workshops around that, around designing good learning outcomes. It's not always as straightforward as you might think.
Yeah. And the other thing, Lisa, which follows on from what you just said, is that in my experience, and this is something that I have learned, so I didn't come into the profession, you know, in DCU knowing this actually, you also need to be able to backward map in writing learning outcomes. So, and that assumes a certain pedagogical and content knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Have some sense of the typical trajectory of learning in the particular domain of knowledge, so that you can identify, for example, what the building blocks are, what the students, as I would put it, who are likely to fly above the others, might achieve under optimal learning conditions. So there's a stretch within it, but there's also natural progression. And to be able to craft that at the early stages of modular programmatic design assumes very strong pedagogical and content knowledge, and also a very strong understanding of how people learn at whatever level. I think the other parts are a little easier. I think, you know, constructing or identifying potential approaches to teaching and learning and modalities of assessment, I think they're a little easier to do. I think the really tricky bit is the crafting of incremental learning outcomes. The other big challenge, and I suppose we're kind of moving on, Lisa, are we a bit from that issue of the advantages to might be the challenges?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to be clear in our journey for colleagues, when we use backward design and constructive alignment, if we genuinely use them and we base them on their use on social constructivism, which is the principle that students and teachers engage in a social or way in crafting the learning journey, that really assumes that we are willing to relinquish some of the control, that we are willing to allow and periodically seek out student ownership of the learning.
Mm-hmm. Now,
what that means in practice is that if I'm teaching, for example, 430 students in E218 in the Institute of Education, that I look at my 40 or 50 minute lecture and I say, okay, I've got content, but my focus is always on regulating that and giving the students an opportunity to regulate that and to reflect on what they're supposedly learning and to identify roadblocks along the way. And in that way, they co-construct. Getting students to buy into that is challenging. I have found in my own practice that I'm fortunate because typically I'm either talking about assessment, learning, and teaching, because that's what I teach. So my there's an alignment between my content and what I'm my processes of learning. So for me, it makes intuitive sense, and for the students, it makes intuitive sense for me to stop and say, "Look at what we're doing here. Look at how I'm going to regulate the learning." How does that fit into the principles of assessment, learning, and teaching? They're very happy to engage with that because there is an alignment between the process and the product. What it is that we are learning, the learning outcomes, and how I'm teaching and how we're engaging. Where it's more challenging is where I'm teaching, for example, and I'll take a very practical example because you'll have been in this class, Lisa. You know where I'm doing teaching research methods, doctor level.
Oh yes,
yes. And I'm saying, okay. So today we're talking about mixed methods research and methodological ecumenism, and the idea that it's not quant or qual, it's a mixture of the two. And I say, look, you know, here's what I want you to learn, and here's how I want you to engage in that. I'm going to stop periodically because, you know, it's important that we co-construct this. People in that room will be saying, would you ever get on with it? We're here to learn about mixed methods research. How you do it is up to you, and it's your responsibility. I'll take responsibility for my personal learning, but I'm not responsible for co-creating, you know, the learning with the person beside me. And if you suggest to me that we should do group work, I'm likely to say, well, who's in the group? What are the implications of that for me? So, you know, I prefer to do it on my own. But the tension here, I think, for other people in particular, where there is not a natural alignment between the content of the lectures and a focus on how students learn is that they can seem to be in competition and irrelevant to the students.
Yes.
When students are under pressure to cover the content so that they are seen to graduate with the knowledge and the expertise specific to, for example, business education or specific to computer education, and they're unlikely to be asked about how they learn or how they're going to co-construct and ensure the learning for others.
That's really interesting, because I think what you're talking about really is about a partnership between yourself and the students, as well as the students amongst themselves. And that's actually an area of great focus and research within the TEU, is students as partners in assessment.
Yes.
So you can see that there's already an impetus across DCU to consider that they, you know, they are not just co-creators, they're true partners in involvement, engagement with assessment design. And that can be in very small steps or yes. in much broader case. But I know we could talk about this all day, Zita. I am very yes. conscious of our time and that we are just about done. So can I just maybe finish off by asking just a very simple, or not, perhaps not so simple, question. So in your experience, we talked about constructive alignment, we talked about backward design, we didn't even get to touch on formative assessment yet, but if you were to give any piece of advice from your own teaching, from your own practice, you know, if somebody was still perhaps a little bit unsure about this, or perhaps how to engage with students, or how to present their ideals around teaching, learning and assessment, is there any singular pieces of advice that you might give?
Let me give three pieces of advice. The first is to be kind to yourself. What we're asking here is not easy. In a formative assessment, you talk about the spirit and the letter of assessment. The spirit is where actually you embrace it to the extent that there is true partnership, and that's the ideal. However, the letter of it is where you take small steps and incrementally you change practice at a pace and a pitch which works for you and for the students. Because if you were to be honest about this, we're not just talking about tips and tricks. We're talking about very fundamentally changing many of the practices with which we are all very familiar. And we're working in an environment in DCU, and DCU is the same as many others, where it's a very, very big institution with very high ambitions. And it puts an awful lot of time and effort into ensuring that there is transparency, that there is clarity at program and design level. So students, when they're coming to the university, they can access programs, they can see what they're getting into, if you like, and what that program is likely to prepare them for. So we have to meet that agenda, and we can't drop that agenda in trying also to involve students more actively in the teaching and learning. But there is a tension between them. So I would say, tout small, and take it slowly, and be kind to and respectful, if you like, of the efforts we're currently making. Second thing I'd say is that, linked to that, this will take time, because it requires competencies and professional knowledge and skill, and that I'm including students in that, which we may not currently have. So whether it's writing really clear learning outcomes, whether it's revisiting the principles of behaviorism, constructivism, social constructivism, and how they impact how we align, they are all the ingredients that allow us to do this well. So there are, and they will, and we can't assume that we have those to start with. Okay, so we can't assume that we're armed to do this. And I think the third thing is, and this is something that you, Lisa, and your colleagues have been doing so well, it's about giving opportunities for people to share their concerns, as I'm doing this morning, honestly and frankly, so that we support the conversation, and we identify what we're doing well, and we identify, you know, who might be at a point where they could contribute to this conversation and support it. So it's, again, it's the collective. That's what I'd say.
Wonderful. What a lovely note to end on. Zita, can I just say thank you very much for an illuminating conversation this morning, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Fantastic. Lisa, thank you. A real privilege and a pleasure.